The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. My name is Lindsay Rowntree. I am COO at ExchangeWire. And today I am joined by our very own Matt Broughton, research lead also at ExchangeWire. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Lindsay. Great to be here.
Good to have you. I'm looking forward to some Matt stats later, which I'm sure you'll be
absolutely. They'll be thrown in, I'm sure.
Excellent. And I'm delighted to welcome our special guest today, who is Mark Krebs, Chief Strategy Officer, Publicis Media, Singapore and Southeast Asia. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Lindsay. Hi. And hi, Matt.
Great to have you as a guest. And yes, obviously you're from the other side of the world from where we are. So we're looking forward to some interesting insights. And as you just mentioned to us pre-recording, you travel a lot, you've just relocated. So I'm sure there's going to be lots of insight from kind of your various experiences all over the world.
We'll see.
Fingers crossed. Right, I'm going to get us going with the first story. So this comes from ExchangeWire and the AOP. So the Coalition, and prepare for a lot of acronyms, there's quite a few in this one, the Coalition for Privacy Compliance in Advertising, the CPCA, has announced it is working with the ICO, the Information Commissioner's Office here in the UK, to develop a world first, a regulator-approved privacy certification for digital advertising technology. This aims to clarify how the UK GDPR, do you need the acronym? Do you know what that means? Applies to digital advertising, ensuring all players in the advertising ecosystem, both large and small, are adhering to the same privacy standards. The certification is being developed in collaboration with some key industry bodies. So ISBAR, the Incorporated Society of British Advertisers, the AOP, the Association of Online Publishers, and there are also others set to join the CPCA's governing board in the coming months. The scheme will initially be audited by the Audit Bureau of Circulation, ABC UK. Now, no one's saying the GDPR isn't clear, insert eye roll here, but we can all agree its interpretation across the advertising industry specifically hasn't been especially consistent, particularly with certain players being accused of using privacy requirements as a justification for anti-competitive measures. So I want to get both of your thoughts on this. Do you think this can work? Are we talking about like a B Corp for privacy? And is it really a helpful standard if it only applies to one market? So Mark, I'm going to come to you for your thoughts first on this.
Thanks, Lindsay. Yeah, so, I mean, coming from Southeast Asia, data maturity and kind of legislation in this space across the region is definitely still kind of an emerging thing. It's very different market by market. But from the point of view of mature markets like the UK, you know, many kind of Western countries, it's a great initiative, to be honest. I'm thinking most folks would have hoped that something like this was in existence some time ago. The timeliness of this seems like it, to me, like it's kind of playing catch up, if anything. To me, thinking about the kind of regional and global advertisers that we have, from a brand perspective, they've been thinking about privacy and data compliance for obviously for many years now. On the agency side, we work with our legal teams on data processing agreements and those sorts of things. Obviously, in the media agency side, when we're handling consumer data, we don't want to get caught out either. And it feels like what might have happened in between is these kind of third-party ad tech vendors possibly haven't been scrutinized as heavily as what agencies and their clients possibly have been. So yeah, more oversight and regulation here is great. It's funny you mentioned B Corp. I think, I don't know, just my view of B Corp is good in theory, bad in practice. I just see that that, you know, there's a lot of B Corp certifications. It's obviously very hard and it's the kind of gold standard, which is great. But then, you know, the next minute you see some of these companies and even media agencies that are B Corp falling out of B Corp status. And it just makes me think, I wonder if, you know, if it was so hard to register for these things, what shouldn't they have known or foreseen that these are also the kind of companies that would easily fall off these things? What I mean by that is the idea of longevity to these kinds of certifications. Just bouncing around there. But, yeah, I mean, I think for a mature market like the UK to have an initiative like this is a good thing, don't get me wrong, but possibly should have come around a while ago, if anything.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. I think the GDPR has caused, you know, many problems in the UK market, you know, obviously across Europe as well. And Mark, you come from a region like Europe, which is many different markets all trying to kind of work together in some way, but all kind of very different in terms of how they operate, their culture, their languages, obviously. And as you mentioned at the start, data privacy is at a very, very different stage of progress in those markets as compared to what it is in Europe. Can you foresee something like this working well? Can you see something like GDPR working across multiple markets in that region? And then do you think there's something like this new initiative to help standardize everything so that both large and small players are on the same playing field? Can you see it actually working in Southeast Asian region?
I mean, we always say sort of by default that Southeast Asia and kind of APAC is the most diverse kind of region in the world.
Absolutely.
You've got like ultra mature markets like the kind of Singapore's and kind of Australia's and those sorts of things, right back to some, you know, emerging markets that this isn't even on their radar, this idea of consumer privacy. Some countries that are still really dealing with, kind of issues around corruption and those sorts of things. So this is kind of not high on their radar, I think. So for me to kind of sit here and speculate, could it something like this work all encompassing across the region? I doubt it. I'd be hopeful, but I doubt it. I think obviously over time this could happen, but I don't know. I really don't see it something soon. I think the mature markets really need to try to work better in the region to kind of, show a path forward for the emerging market.
Set an example.
But like you said, there's so many just language barriers and just kind of internet adoption and all of those sorts of things, which is so widely different in the region that this is it's a complex issue even in the UK itself, let alone the rest of Europe. Like that's probably magnified 10x in this part of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes total sense. Matt, I'm going to come to you now. What are your thoughts on this? Do you see this being an effective measure?
I agree with Mark in the sense that anything that can reduce market uncertainty around data legislation, particularly as it pertains to ad tech and digital advertising, it's a good thing. But surely this should have been brought in many years ago. It's been 6 years since GDPR was released. UK GDPR is pretty much a word-for-word copy of the European legislation, so it obviously doesn't differ too much at this point in time. And to me, it kind of raises enforcement questions. As per Mattia Foschi, anonymized CEO, in the press release announcing release of this certification, while independent ad tech providers sometimes sell products and practices with questionable legal compliance. If it's questionable legal compliance, then shouldn't that be something that the regulators should have jumped on previously? You're openly almost admitting to that. And I wouldn't say that's a point against the ICO specifically. I think it raises broader questions around the regulation of tech and the application of these, wide sweeping privacy regulations. But yeah, it just seems, it's a good idea, but it just seems a little too late. But yeah.
And we know that the ICO, as one example, pick a data office, any data office across Europe, they're all quite badly understaffed and they aren't able to kind of go after everybody. Do you think that actually having something like this as a different layer of regulation on top of GDPR will actually help them out and encourage people to want to be compliant and actually understand what compliance actually means? Do you think it's going to be useful?
Yeah, I think it definitely will be useful, and I think it'll be particularly useful to the smaller startup firms such as the brands who are first branching out into digital advertising beyond the walled gardens, as an example, because they're not going to have the time or resources to pore over the very heavy legislative text that is GDPR. But actually having this certification, obviously depending on how it's priced, having this certification to be able to give them a quick TLDR of how privacy regulation pertains to digital advertising, it could be really helpful in that regard.
Excellent. Lovely insights there. Thank you both. I'm going to move us on to our second story, which is, if I can just find it on my list. Right, so this one's about, insert expectant drum roll, please, Google. So a US judge, James Donato in San Francisco, has ordered the Alphabet-owned company to give Android users more options to download apps and pay for transactions within them. So some details, and if I've missed anything out, don't at me, because some details. For 3 years, Google cannot prohibit the use of in-app payment methods and must allow users to download competing third-party Android app platforms and stores. For example, the Epic Game Store can be downloaded and accessed directly within the Google Play Store, if that got a bit confusing for you, because it did for me when I first read it. Google is also restricted from making payments to device makers, such as Samsung, to pre-install its App Store on new devices. This is otherwise known as preload, for those of you who aren't aware of what this system is. You might buy a phone and it's got already got app stores and apps on it. That's called preload. And also from sharing revenue generated from the Play Store with other app distributors. Now, Epic didn't have quite the same success with the Apple ruling early last year. And while some changes will be made on the Apple Epic front, which we talked about in the episode on 16th of August with Performance's Tiago Correa, if anyone remembers that wonderful episode, this ruling against Google goes much further to opening up the ecosystem. So to both of you, and Matt, I want to come to you first on this one, especially as our resident gaming guru. Kind of, what do you think is going to happen here? What impact will this have on the market? Will it open everything up?
So obviously Google are looking to appeal, which is why the initial share price loss wasn't too dramatic and in fact has since recovered. So nothing imminent is going to happen. I mean,
Google appeals everything.
Yeah,
if they
exactly.
didn't appeal, I'd be very worried.
Yeah, they'll probably launch an appeal after the appeal and then an appeal after that appeal just to satisfy things. But I think removing the contingencies around Google Play billing and those in-app payments, I think that's probably going to be the most significant aspect of the ruling in practice. I think in terms of downloading the third-party app stores, such as the Epic Games Store, I think that will probably only really pertain to certain niches, gaming obviously being the most front of mind there. Beyond those niches, developers will still publish their apps via the Google Play Store because that's where the audience is. Like, they're not just going to abandon it en masse, say, for, you know, Spotify as an example. They're not going to go, we won't be on Google Play anymore, we're going to download, you know, launch our own app store just for the Spotify app. So I don't think it'll have too much impact in practice there. The only way it could potentially have an impact is in conjunction with obviously the Google search trial that was ruled upon recently. There's discussion about spinning out Android or certain elements within that. So that could open up the opportunity for new phone manufacturers. Obviously it's been, you know, pretty Samsung heavy and Android carries heavy and obviously the iPhone. But looking back, you know, to the past decade, Windows Phone didn't really take off because it didn't have those third-party apps. So actually this coming into practice could change that, but that's a bit sort of future-gazing rather than anything imminent. I do adore the line from the judge to the Google lawyers in a hearing earlier in August, though. You're going to end up paying something to make the world right after having been found to be a monopolist. It's just
I enjoyed
such
that.
such a delicious line there. Finally, I think in terms of how it's going to be implemented, I think the implementation is going to be really interesting in the sense that obviously the judge has mandated that Epic and Google must establish a three-person technical committee with one from Google, one from Epic, and one decided by the two of them. It's an interesting way of potentially lightening the burden on the courts and the legislators, but I just feel it could end up being a source of backlog and having to go back to the courts anyway if these three individuals end up disagreeing, which, let's be honest, they almost certainly will. And yeah, the sense it's a permanent injunction, but it's only applying for 3 years once it goes in, which in the world of tech cycles is relatively short, unless I've missed some kind of legal extension to that. But yeah, it just seems a little short for what's supposed to be permanent reparations as such for this antitrust activity.
100%. Loads of fascinating thoughts there, Matt. And I did enjoy as well kind of the Epic, you choose one person, Google, you choose one person, and both of you choose the other. I thought, I want to use that in life, but I think you're right. It will still get complicated.
It's a little bit nursery, isn't it? You need to play
great,
with his
though.
Toys. You need to play with her toys and all together.
Definitely. Mark, I want to come to you next. And I want to obviously, Southeast Asia, mobile first region. Yep. So the impact of this more generally, but also from your perspective strategically, kind of how just opening things up more generally and kind of trying yep. to move people away from the monopolies, kind of what impact that has more generally on how you guys do your jobs and work within agencies and kind of clients and everything else. I'm fascinated on kind of what your perspective is on that side of things as well.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, in Southeast Asia, we kind of really see the market or the region as almost like the epicenter for gaming and more broadly APAC as well, I guess. With this one, Samsung is actually a client of ours, so I probably don't want to bash on the Google-Samsung partnership too much. But
certainly not.
100%. This is all about consumer choice. The broader implications, you know, of these kind of lawsuits and things stacking up against Google and their monopolistic kind of quasi-monopolistic behavior is where it's going for sure. What that means, I mean, as we've seen, I think we just touched on, is within the walled gardens, they're definitely been getting an unfair share of media spends for probably quite some time. And, you know, half or more of kind of impressions are on the open web. So we see from an advertising perspective that clients do need to be quite mindful about, I guess, over-investing too much into the walled gardens in general. More specifically on this topic, though, is it a good thing? Yeah, more choice is always good for consumers. Like I said, gaming in this part of the world where it's so diverse, you've got really mature markets and you've got these kind of emerging markets. Everyone's on their phone. Everyone is playing mobile games. It's just massive down here. And I think for consumer choice to be so restricted in this space is definitely not beneficial for advertisers. I thought there was an interesting, the other little comment in the article itself that I thought was interesting, I don't know if it was fortuitous or you'd arranged it this way, was that Google was actually arguing Epic's proposed reforms could harm consumer privacy and security, which is obviously what we were just talking about in the first question. I thought that was quite interesting as well. You know, I think the broader implications for Google, despite the 2% hit on shares, you know, it's kind of an ongoing theme here. So let's see where it goes for further kind of cases against them when it comes to this kind of quasi-monopolistic behavior.
And I'm interested as well on both your thoughts on, you know, when Apple had to change how they operate somewhat in this same regard because of the DMA ruling, and they've basically just kind of gone, listen, you can use this third-party payment system, but look, here's our wonderful, secure, excellent payment system. Do you feel like if Google eventually loses this after many appeals, they will just do the same thing? And it's the loopholes, right? They are playing by the rules, but not in a particularly kind of fair way, and they will still encourage consumers who don't know any better and don't really understand the choice that is afforded to them to still go with the Google option or still go with the Apple option. And actually, is this all just fairly futile?
I think in terms of it's how big tech tends to play against this kind of regulation. Obviously, I think one example that springs to mind on top of this is Meta in terms of their user consent mechanism. They were for years, obviously, you know, you have to change your form of consent that users give for the use of their data. And then it obviously got years and years down the court process. And then they eventually went, you have to pay to not have targeted advertising, which is obviously, you know, really against the spirit of legislation, and they were eventually called out on it. But they always, like you say, they always try and go for these loopholes. So yeah, if this, you know, the appeal is unsuccessful for Google, they probably will look towards some kind of loophole mechanism. But because they're under scrutiny in so many areas, they may not be able to use those loopholes as readily as their other big tech rivals.
I'd love to say that we planned it this way, that the story, to your point earlier, Mark, that the CPCA story and this story kind of were beautifully fortuitously tied in together. I mean, we're not that smart, honestly, but it's worked out quite well. But actually, the regulation, the audit is designed to ensure that the large players and the small players are operating in the same levels. Actually, that applies very well to this story because, again, you've got the big players kind of going, okay, fine, we'll play by the rules. I'm using air quotes here. And we'll kind of make up the rules as we go along as well. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, Mark?
We've got a bunch of Fin Services clients. So this idea that Google's not going to play by the rules and then kind of give preferential treatment for their own payment options. That's exactly what all of the Fin Services brands through all of the various different payment gateways and platforms. That's what they're trying to do, is to get top of wallet, and that's exactly what Google's going to do. Is it's going to be, you know, so big and easy for you to buy stuff, using their method to buy, so that you can just make it simple and easy, and then just completely make it hard to do anything else. How do you regulate that? More oversight? I don't know. But for sure, you know, this is this kind of ongoing thing here where, they will keep getting hit and keep appealing. And then, like Matt said, it's really not a long-term play for them. They'll probably already be sitting there thinking about what's plan A, plan B, plan C, even if they have to swallow these proposals, they will already have these options here, which still makes them as much money as possible anyway.
Yeah, wonderful. On that cheery note about them getting as much money as they possibly can, I'm going to move us on to our third story, which is hopefully slightly more upbeat. So this comes from Instacart with the announcement they will be expanding their partnership with Roku to make TV moments shoppable for high-intent customers. It's obviously no surprise that the two topics everyone's talking about at the moment, I didn't roll my eyes there, they're genuinely exciting topics, CTV and retail media are coming together. And the new ad capabilities will include shoppable ads. So on Roku, CPG advertisers can create a direct path to purchase from their ad creative via text messaging or QR code, with Instacart as landing destination. There's also home screen ad formats. So advertisers can now make targeted, high impact shoppable placements on the Roku home screen that drive users to purchase those products on Instacart, and then targeting. So brands can now better reach consumers on Roku by delivering more relevant ads based on their Instacart purchase behavior. So again, I want to get your thoughts on this. Do we think that the coming together of CTV and retail media is inevitable? Do we think shoppable ads are the future of CTV? Mark, I'm going to get your thoughts on this first.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this is another one where it's a great move, but it's kind of almost table stakes now, playing kind of catch up with these big brand advertising upper funnel kind of touch points being shoppable. Pick a platform, pick a media channel. Literally everyone's already doing this. Good that they've got this kind of bespoke partnership with Instacart, but my guess is Instacart are also doing this with other media channels and partnerships as well. The reality on this one to me is kind of like, wherever an advertiser can make their upper mid funnel kind of advertising shoppable, great, should do it. But the expectation needs to be very clear for advertisers that it's like, just because it is shoppable doesn't mean everyone's buying it. And it just immediately makes me think of, Ehrenberg Bass has kind of got this kind of ratio, golden ratio they've talked about for a while now of 95-5, which is basically to say that 95% of customers in any category are not ready to buy your product or service within a given period. That period is different for different categories. So for CPG, it might be your weekly grocery shop. Well, 95% of consumers aren't ready to buy the juice that week because they've already got 4 liters of it at home. I'm just making up as a terrible example. But I think the watch out here is that, as more and more of these, let's just call it like kind of brand advertising channels become shoppable, marketers need to realize that it doesn't change those laws of growth, really. There's still only so so many people who are ready to buy a specific product or service at any point in time. And that roughly is around 5%. So even though it's slightly easier to buy, doesn't mean people all of a sudden there's more of them. And this is why, you know, CTV is important, because it's about big, beautiful brand ads, so that when the person is ready to buy, you catch them when they fall, and the Instacart option is there for them.
And I'm interested in this, your perspective on this, Mark, as well, based on the fact, again, that you are obviously based out in Singapore and Southeast Asia, where shoppable commerce, social commerce are arguably streets ahead of what we're seeing in Europe and the US. So do you see these kind of stories come out of the US where they're going, this is so innovative and creative, and you're like, we've been doing this for bloody years now. This is not a thing. And as you kind of highlighted, you know, okay, great, that's really good for you, but actually you won't see the growth that you're all expecting to see because of this 95-5 ratio. What are you seeing happening in Southeast Asian region and the Asian region more general that's kind of we should be looking at and going, wow, that's amazing?
Yeah, well, I think you already mentioned that we're such a mobile first region. This is definitely not to say that you know, multi-screen advertising is less important. So naturally, even down here, when we run things like MMM or whatever, we see similar sort of scenarios where, you know, the bigger the screen, the better the ROI, audio, visual, sound on, non-skippable, all of this kind of stuff, right? But in Southeast Asia, it's kind of like that's the screen that's kind of king.
For and listeners, so, Mark is holding up his mobile phone, his cell phone, because that is
uses. The smaller one. And so what we see right across APAC is just how influencer commerce is becoming so much more important. The idea that entertainment and shopping, and it's kind of like being stuck onto a brand advert, is almost becoming a very different thing in APAC and specifically Southeast Asia. This idea of shoppertainment is really blowing up. You've got all of this live stream shopping going on now. It's becoming fairly crazy, and to be honest, somewhat unwieldy for the agencies that are managing a lot of this stuff. Good place for ad tech to try to come in and kind of resolve the idea that you've got, you know, loads and loads of different influencers selling different products across different live streams. It's the human resource on doing things like that at scale across the region, very, very difficult, but that's where it's headed. I think CTV still really important in the region, but this blending of brand and sales activation, the real kind of innovation area is definitely around live streaming commerce for sure in this part of the world.
That's really interesting. Matt, what's your take on this story?
I pretty much agree mostly with what Mark's been saying. I think in terms of the marrying of retail media and CTV, clearly it's going to be a very important revenue driver for anyone involved in CTV, which is why obviously we've seen the likes of Walmart shelling out $2.5 billion for Vizio. I do think there are pain points that need to be overcome with CTV. Obviously, you know, taking this partnership as an example, it's fantastic for CPG brands selling specific goods to Instacart users on Roku. What if you're in a different vertical to CPG? What if you want to target users across all TV sets rather than just those on Roku? And I think there was a lovely and relevant quote from Jeff Green at ATS London this year. We have to make certain that the supply chain of the open internet is better than that of walled gardens. And I think in terms of that fragmentation, we need to make those supply channels, you know, more cohesive for this kind of thing to really take off. And to Mark's point in terms of how, you know, few consumers are at that buying moment, there's a quote from the press release that kind of worries me in that regard. And that's that brands can now also better reach consumers on Roku by delivering more relevant ads based on their Instacart purchase behavior. Then goes on to explicitly mention zero sugar drinks and those who have purchased kids products as an example. And to me, this kind of just seems a bit like the tail wagging the dog. Broadcasters, if you take it back to what TV is fundamentally, broadcasters and TV publishers, they release programs to make money predominantly via advertising or user subscriptions. The more popular or interesting or relevant that TV program is, the more people will view it, and therefore the more attractive it is to a brand to advertise against. That kind of, you know, rationale of let's show an ad for a zero sugar drink because they've purchased the zero sugar drink in the past, it just doesn't fit into that value exchange to me. And it kind of smacks of the, you know, retargeting bollocks that's plagued display advertising over the past decade or more. And it's just something that I think, yes, it can be really, really powerful for that, you know, 5% that are in that purchasing moment. But for those who aren't, don't overemphasize and overengage on this, you know, type of performance play, because it's just going to, you know, devalue, you know, the branding elements of TV and obviously indeed going forward CTV.
It ties in with what Mark was saying earlier as well about the fact that, you know, you might target somebody with some juice, but they've already got 4 litres of juice at home and they're not ready to buy it yet. And whenever I see stories like this, I do always think back to my early days of advertising where we were trying to convince our clients to advertise on mobile. And they go, well, none of my clients are going to buy a washing machine on mobile. And you go, no, but it's not about that. It's about being there. Like, they might not buy it on the mobile, but they're doing their research on their mobile. And then they'll go and maybe buy it on a desktop later. And trying to convince them to appear on mobile for that reason, when all they were thinking about was the final sale, it does make me think about, would a CP, you know, are CPGs or any kind of brands ready to advertise on that environment with the intent of actually getting a sale out of it? Or do they still see TV or want the TV environment, the CTV environment, to be an awareness environment and be a top of funnel environment rather than going, you're here to shop? And maybe, you know, Instacart Roku is a good example, because actually I'm more likely to buy a bottle of juice or a zero sugar drink than I am a washing machine. But it does still feel to me like, are brands ready to take that leap and actually advertise on those platforms for those reasons rather than for the kind of brand awareness reasons that they are typically used to?
It's definitely one way or another for advertisers. There's a net benefit there every time you're opening up new sales distribution channels. So this is effectively trying to do that. It increases physical availability, and so therefore that's in theory a good thing, opening up new ways to sell your product. I think, I mean, it could come down to what is the actual CX or UX of the thing. Like, how easy is it to actually buy that thing that you've just seen an ad for? I mean, this concept, it's been around for years. This article is just a new partnership in this space. I thought it was interesting in the article that. I mean, I think they were dialing up the idea that, you know, you could buy this thing and you can obviously have it delivered within whatever time
within
frame
the
it
hour,
was.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, and I don't know. I'm just kind of like, okay, cool. Especially for, you know, Instacart is massive in San Francisco. I can't remember how big it is across the rest of the states, but, you know, it's so easy for someone in the, you know, Western countries to just go down to the store and buy that bottle of juice. Like, if you're literally having to click on for CPG brands when you're already going to do your weekly shop when you're down at the grocery, or you're going to go straight to Instacart, put your whole shop there and have your whole, like, the concept that it's one ad and it's a buyable juice or margarine and have that delivered. I mean, it's a bit clunky for me to kind of see this working well for CPG. It's interesting when it's starting to bundle things together. So what are the deals and what are the offers that they're going to be providing? And to me, that's probably more for the brands and the advertisers. But see what the experience ends up being and how successful it is, I guess.
That's a really good point, and Matt, your thoughts on this be interesting too. From a consumer perspective, like, what am I going to do? What's the path of least resistance? I see an Instacart ad on the TV when I'm watching Roku. Am I going to text messaging or QR code? Am I going to open my phone and scan the QR code, or will I open my phone and just open the Instacart app immediately? Like, what am I going to do? Like, my first port of call will be just go in and open the app automatically. So as you said, Mark, it's about the offers they are, the kind of the Roku exclusive offers they're able to display on your TV screen to make you want to click the QR code and know that I'll only get this offer on this product if I scan this QR code here and now. And if I just open my Instacart app, will that really work? And again, it comes down to there'll be some clunkiness in the measurement of things, I imagine, as well with this, because there will be so many people that will just open up the app directly. Will they be able to track those users that have seen that from an Instacart ad? Like, it's all going to be a very interesting way forward. Like, Matt and Mark, actually, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think TV needs to have a look, you know, we discussed social commerce as an example, in terms of lowering that kind of user friction in the experience. I think that's what's going to be key to making this kind of thing really take off. Because at the moment, you know, this kind of thing, it sounds like it's appealing to hungover consumers who just want to stay on their sofa and press a button and happy days. Whereas, you know, normally would I want to, you know, if I see an advert for something, would I want to, if I'm on the sofa, dig around, try and find my phone, hold it up to the screen, take a picture of the QR code, press the link that the QR code picks up. It's just a little bit clunky. Whereas if it was all in the one, you know, more seamless experience, I think that would be, you know, more interesting as a proposition. We're, you know, starting to see experiments with that. Obviously, we've got the likes of Telly. We've discussed it previously on the podcast. The TV manufacturer that gives away sets for free, but with a second screen underneath. I think that's a bit like, you know, trying to dissect a meringue with a sledgehammer. It's a little bit overkill. But I think something, you know, experimentation along those lines, maybe having a more seamless link between the TV and the phone so that when an advert comes up, you've got a TV app on your phone, which you can just literally press a button and it adds it to a basket. Or, you know, you can even use that as a branding tool maybe, and it will give, you know, further information or link out to the page of the specific company that's advertising. Or maybe we'll see experimentation with remote controls. They're obviously very analog at the moment, but we may see sort of smarter remote controls come in with secondary ad screens on them that you can press onto and do it that way via, rather than, like I say, doing this rather clunky QR scanning process. But yeah, I think there'll be innovations around that to really make it take off. But yeah, look to reduce the user friction, I would say.
And that more scalable version, I guess more the open web scalable version, that's been there for years, a technology called kind of different holdcos will call it different things, but TV sync. So you can line up a second screen media buy that syncs up with your TVC.
Yeah.
So that they don't have to scan anything. I mean, if they happen to be holding their phone there, they will already get served an ad that is triggered based on the TV spot. So yeah, I mean, I take that point as well a bit with the cake and the sledgehammer thing. I mean, this is net benefit's a good thing. Like I said, having extra retail channels for products, but yeah, I think it definitely going to remain to be seen. You know, how much product are they selling through this one partnership versus other means?
Yeah, absolutely. And Matt, I've got to ask you, digging around to find your phone, are you not a dual screener? You're not lying on the sofa with a TV screen here and then holding your phone on Instagram or something all the time you're watching TV, digging around for your phone? I don't believe you.
Yeah, it depends. I think it depends whether you're, you know, TV watching or film watching. I think films you tend to be a bit more engrossed into, but TV shows, yeah, it's a bit more, right, I'm just going to flick through my phone, but...
I mean, fair enough. Can't argue with that. I'm going to end it there. Thank you so much, both of you. That's been a really, really good chat. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Mark, for joining me today.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Thanks, Lindsay.
And thank you, everyone, for listening.